don't know if you're commuting by train, but if you do, have you ever dropped anything from the platform onto the track?
I did read, I was listening to your, well, actually previous I read one. The transcript for the previous one of the dropped earboard.
Highly irritating. Yeah.
I come into Waterloo, which is why we're in Covent Garden, because I get to choose where the office goes, which is quite nice.
Very handy.
Where do you come in from?
Hazelmere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very nice.
Okay.
So a reader writes in saying that he once dropped a pair of sunglasses at Ewell West Station, and he said, tell Hughesy he's a wuss, because he definitely didn't jump down and pick them up. So there we go.
You'll be careful, haven't you?
But there was no staff around and there was no one around.
I did threaten to go down, and he said, you'll be arrested if you do that. I was like, probably being FCA regulated is not,
don't go there.
Not a good idea. I'll lose you. I actually got the airport back.
Did you?
So 2 days, I went there.
Really? That's
I went there the next day, and because he promised, the guard I spoke to said he'd try and get it, but he had to shut, he had to turn the electricity off on the line. So I was like, that's never going to happen. So I went back the next day, and he was like, no, we haven't had time to turn the electricity off. It's far too busy. And there's train delays. And I was like, he was like, but give me your number and we'll try and do it in the middle of the night, basically. And then I got a call to say they'd got it. And I thought, and it had been raining straight for 2 days. So I thought there was no chance. And I got it home and kind of cleaned it up a bit, because my assistant said, you know, there'd be rats crawling over your AirPods. I was like, oh, I don't want to put it in my ear now. So I got the Milton out and cleaned it all up and tried to use it. And it was half sound. So I thought, it's gone. And then we were away over the weekend and my sister's in Sheffield. And I left it on the radiator.
So put it in the air and cupboard.
And I used it last night and it worked.
Oh, so that's the ending to that story.
To my story.
So any listeners, viewers out there, get in touch with your stories of things that you've dropped on railway stations onto the platform.
Exactly.
That'd be great. It could be a little theme for the pod. good. Well, there's missiles flying over Russia, so it's probably quite a good time to start, is it? Should we get on with it before World War III kicks off?
Yeah. Or it snows.
43? Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell. Joined as always by James Hughes, called Chief Investment Manager, and today also joined by Rob Marshall Lee. Rob, good afternoon. Rob is the founding partner and Chief Investment Officer of Kusana Capital. Rob was at Newton Investment Management for 21 years, managing the emerging market strategy, which was top 1% versus other emerging market funds over 1, 5, and 9.5 years since inception of the fund, generating outperformance of 6% per annum over and above the benchmark. He joined OD Asset Management in early 2021 and was founding partner of Kusana in March 2022. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of February, March.
February, March 2022. Rob, thank you for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
Yeah. We're going to talk about emerging markets, because there's one thing we've not actually talked about in the podcast, is that we've done Japan, we've done America a few times.
Well, we probably covered more Asia with Carly,
didn't we?
A little bit of EM, but no, it felt like the right time to have an EM specialist on.
So. Yeah. So what people in finance tend to do is like divvy up the market into different areas, sectors and geographies. So I thought it'd be helpful to give some wide background in terms of what are emerging markets. Two graphics here, giving the left-hand chart, giving the geography of what the emerging markets index covers. So China makes up roughly 25% of the index, Taiwan and India both about 18-19%, followed by Korea, which MSCI classify as an emerging market, but I don't think that FTSE don't. So there's a bit of a quirk in the system there. And then after that, you've got Brazil, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Mexico, Indonesia, making up the rest of the top 10. In terms of the sector distribution of stocks in the emerging markets, technology makes up by far the biggest sector at 35-36%. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the big Asian tech giants, the Chinese names in particular. Financials are the second biggest sector at 24%. Then we've got consumer cyclicals, basic materials, industrials, energy, all on sort of single digit. So different, I guess, Chinese and technology are the two kind of big sectors there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And very different businesses, I guess, to the Magnificent Seven in terms of kind of valuation. And is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they're amazing businesses. So I actually bought Tencent for the first time in 2008 when I was a global PM. And I couldn't persuade any of my colleagues to buy it because it was trading on 30 times multiple and it compounded at 40% plus for the next 10, 12 years.
And what did Tencent do?
50 times your money, 70 times your money.
Cool. Well, that's kind of right, isn't it?
So that was the biggest position in the Newton Fund for a 10-year period, basically. Mm. And you know, when you're running an 8% position, which goes up 50 times, you know, we're constantly trimming it.
Mm.
But it's the key is to kind of stay the course, understand the value creation by that business. You know, it's phenomenally positioned with the rise of iPhones and the mobile internet and so on.
Yeah.
And it, you know, when I bought it, I had 300 million customers and it controlled the customer experience. So it just progressively monetized that over time as people use them more and more. So, that was long before they became benchmark stocks in 2015, I think it was.
Okay. Oh, right.
So that's one of the keys investing in China over that period was focus on those kind of businesses and avoid all the banks and anything tied in with the property cycle. And that's since blown up.
Yeah, yeah. And then in terms of... Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, because presumably when you started being dedicated as EM manager, it was all about the bricks, but... materials,
commodities,
oil and steel. Gas, that they were all the leading sectors, weren't they, in EM at that time?
So I was a mining analyst back in 2000 till 2005.
Okay.
Which was exactly.
That's when we started our careers.
I know,
it's the happy days. And at that point in time, you know, when I took it on in 2000, mining was heavily out of favor. But it was amazing. You know, I quickly realized you needed to focus on the commodities, not so much on the mines and things. And that was how you then worked out which equities you wanted to be in. But then it became quickly apparent that China was more than 100% of marginal demand in the market. And then that's where I needed to spend my efforts. That's why I became an expert on China from 2000 onwards. And you could buy Vale when it was a mid-cap no one had heard of. We made 10 to 15 times the money on things like Vale and BHP. But... we're in a very, you know, we're now in the unwind of the bubble. We've had this kind of sustained period of incredible kind of per capita consumption growth on cement, steel and everything else.
Mm.
And now all of that excess kind of supply is venting around the global market.
Mm.
So I'd be very careful about commodities.
And did it feel quite obvious to you at that time that those stocks and the commodities were going to perform exceptionally well because you just had this massive buyer in the background or is it one of those, it's obvious with the benefit of hindsight, and actually at the time it wasn't so clear?
It sort of was, but all the sell side in 2000 were forecasting bottom of cycle copper forever, 65 cent copper forever. So the shares were valued on like a 10% margin. And what happened is they went from a 10% margin to a 40% margin, 50% margin in iron ore. And then they were making something like a 30% marginal return on capital. And that's when you had this amazing compounding with the volume growth and the high profitability, which is why you make great money on BHP and Vale and so on. But they were very, very far from being consensus trades through a lot of that period. And then they became much bigger stocks. And of course, everyone's wise after the event. But sticking through that and understanding the power of the structural trends, thinking kind of thematically, thinking and keeping your focus on a five-year view is very important.
Mm. Well, that leads me on quite neatly, actually, because I was going to sort of start by that. I mean, how have emerging markets done in terms of stock market performance? MSCI, the index provider, started their EM index in 1987. So we've got a chart here since inception of the EM index versus ACWI, All Country World Index, i.e. the whole equity market. And actually over that period of time, 35, nearly 40 years, emerging markets have outperformed global markets. But as you sort of alluded to there, that period, 99 to 2008-9, was kind of really the sweet spot for emerging markets and probably performed 3x the performance of global developed markets through that period, probably. Yeah. And that was all about that kind of rise of China, wasn't it?
Yes, the operational leverage of a commodity cycle, really.
Mm-hmm.
And also you had the end of the Asia crisis, so 97, 99. Yeah. So you had the kind of rebound from that.
Of course.
And then operational leverage on businesses, but also the sustained industrialization of China lifted a lot of boats. And that led to, for example, not just something like Vale working in Brazil, but the consumer stocks coming from hyperinflation into more restrained inflation, unleashed a consumer boom, the cost of capital came down, and currencies went up. So there are multiple factors, but I think, you know, you've got to be careful about when you look over the last 10 years, there are lots of different moving parts within that. This is not a homogeneous asset class.
No, and in fact, we've got that chart here, but over the more recent period, over the last 10 years, and we can see, in fact, that this is total return. Emerging markets allegedly, I might have to double check this, are only up 10% cumulative in the last 10 years, whereas ACWI's pretty much doubled in that time. So emerging markets have definitely kind of lagged in the last 10 years, haven't they, despite having a really good 40-year period, and that's some of that.
Yeah,
that's some of that.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that this is kind of the point about a strategy like ours is, you know, a lot of the index has gone violently sideways. There's large amounts of state-owned entities and companies which destroy value, which offset these amazing compounding businesses which are tucked within that. So if you're a strategist or, you know, an asset allocator, all you see is the superficial block. But if you're a stock picker, it's an amazing place to generate alpha.
Yeah. And then there's a really interesting chart actually we're going to talk about on that. Before we do, though, in terms of kind of broad market valuation, again, this goes back to inception of the data, of the valuation of EM is at a marked discount to the rest of the world. So this has the EM index on a P ratio of 12, which is pretty low, below its long-term average, and the rest of the world on about 18 and a half, so a pretty marked discount for emerging markets. I do actually remember, if you look back at this chart, 2006-07, there was an inflection point where emerging market valuations were higher than developed world, and I do distinctly remember reading pieces at the time saying, well, of course emerging markets should be on a higher valuation, it's an emerging market, so they should be growing faster. And that was very much consensus, the sort of consensus at the time, isn't it? But history has shown that actually, they haven't grown faster in the aggregate because of some of those reasons you mentioned in terms of, you know, state-owned.
Yeah, and I think when you're doing these, it's good to disaggregate them by country, by sector and things to try and understand the moving parts, but also to plot them against things like return on equity. And, you know, if you think about why the Mag 7's done well, it's because the return on equity's moved up dramatically.
Yeah.
So there's not really a valuation anomaly there. It's probably a valuation anomaly for the rest of the US market, ironically. That's where it's kind of more disconnected from its ROE on a through-cycle basis. You know, Europe's a bit, you know, ho-hum compared with the US on an ROE basis, and so are quite a few of the EMs. But somewhere like India's had a rising return on equity combined with a great growth, you know, driver behind it. And combining those together, then, you know, the high valuations on a PE basis are actually pretty well deserved.
So that return on equity thing, then what does that mean if a Tencent or a Shell or whatever it is has a high return on equity? What does that mean from a sort of fundamental basis of the company?
So this is the kind of thing that very few market commentators focus on, but as a long-term stock picker is the most important thing of all. And the reason for that is, if I'm investing in a business and say I invest £100 in a business and I make £20 back on that each year, I can then reinvest that and you get the compounding effect that a Warren Buffett would talk about. So if you're a one-year investor, that kind of gets lost in the kind of up and downs of the stock market, multiples moving up and down. But if you're a five-year investor, suddenly it becomes 80% of the value is in the kind of the compounding of the earnings and only 20% is in the multiple. It becomes actually much more predictable. So if you can find a company with a sustained high return on equity, or even better, one that starts with a low return and goes to a high return, those are the stocks you make great risk-adjusted returns in. In fact, you make the best returns on those stocks. And that completely changes your mindset. So instead of focusing on earnings upgrades on a 12-month view and what's going to happen to the multiple, which is highly risky and you have very little competitive advantage, if you have the patience to understand that, you can focus on these amazing businesses like Microsoft or an Nvidia, or in the EMs, it would be a Tencent or a TSMC, these companies which compound 20, 30, 40% year after year after year. So they'll confound the casual observer and the strategist. But for the more considered long-term investor, you can find these things again and again and again, and it actually becomes a far more relaxed approach. And you realize it's actually a much lower risk of investing, but higher return combined with a lower risk of permanent loss of capital.
Are you finding a lot of attractive opportunities at the moment that provide you with these sorts of returns?
Yeah, definitely. But you don't find them universally across the market. You know, there's very, very few in Latin America. So generally, for the last 13 years, we've had...
And why is that?
I was going to say, I would have thought it more of a sector thing, right? Certain types of businesses lend themselves naturally.
That is true. So there are some things where the business just has no competitive advantage. So you make really good profits one year and it goes down the next because capital floods in. So we're looking for businesses which have got competitive advantage, economic moats around them, so that there isn't mean reversion. So that might be a right move or something where there's very little competition. It's the equivalent of that in India is growing much faster.
The two things you look for in a high and growing ROE business is the moats that the business has, i.e. it has, you know, Apple is probably one of the best examples, I guess. We've all got an iPhone, or those of us that do would never, ever consider leaving iPhone just because of the upheaval would be far too much, right? I think Warren Buffett was said that the thing with Apple was that if someone offered to pay you $10,000 to never use an Apple product again, you'd probably turn them down. And that is the sort of, that is the classic moat, isn't it? So they can basically charge one.
So when I got married, we went on honeymoon and we bought an Apple iPod and thought that this is really cool. But the Apple shares were trading on 100 times multiple. So we were like, oh no. And then 6 months later, we thought, oh, okay, let's buy some shares anyway. Mm. And we bought them and we made 200% and then sold them again. It felt very clever. But we'd bought them 100 times multiple to start with, and just the earnings moved up dramatically. So everyone was just like, Apple's expensive. But if you bought it and stuck with it today, you made 300 times your money.
Yeah.
So PEs are a very, very lazy valuation measure. We're trying to value the future cash flows of a business. So we need to understand the sustainability of the growth rate. And so the sustainable growth rate of a business, if a company sustains a return on equity, it is the return on equity less any dividends paid out. Dividends compromise that growth. So if you understand that, you're really, really focused on return on equity. And what you need for that is moats around the business, like Apple has, but there are plenty of other businesses like that. Could be strong brands, could be natural platform businesses. There's a variety of different things. Tencent is a great example of that. But also it's the governance. And the big difference we find at the stock level in emerging markets is about governance. So there's a very small minority of businesses in emerging markets, and I'm talking 5% or less, which generate all of the economic returns over time. But to understand that, you need to understand what makes the company tick. Is it a founder-led business? Have they got skin in the game as a management team? And the problem you have in somewhere like Brazil is the local norm is for remuneration structures which don't favor value creation. They're focused on sales growth, EBITDA growth. What that leads you to do is use lots of capital, spend it on growth, but do lots of M&A, raise more capital, spend it. So you're growing your profits, but you're not growing your profits per share. You're not driving value creation. So for us, we need to think, are we aligned as minority investors? And so that is the first question we ask of every investment we make in EM. If that's not the case, straight out the window.
And that's like you think that's a culture thing, Latin America versus other parts of EM versus the US? Because the US would be the classic example of founder-led culture, Zuckerberg, Musk.
Yeah. So it's not universal, is it? I mean, even in the US or UK, there are some companies which care much more about value creation. Some where you're more aligned, more less aligned. And then it's the power of the business model combined with that, which can unleash that compounding effect so powerfully. What we find in EM, it's the dispersion is much wider. So the dispersion between the value creators and the value destroyers is much greater. So we're just trying to avoid the value destroyers and focus all of our efforts on creating a portfolio of value creators.
We've got a chart here on that and this sort of idea of a very few number of companies. I quite like that. So what it sort of shows a skewness of returns, and for those watching and those even not watching, the majority of companies of stocks in EM don't produce good returns, as opposed to in the developed markets where more companies produce average returns. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, the skew is still very dramatic in DM as well. Yeah, so like you see with the Mag 7, most of the returns have been generated by that top seven stocks. But in DM, so particularly in somewhere like Europe or UK, you'll find there's dispersion is just a little less profound than in EM. So in EM, the numbers is 1% of companies by number generated 83% of returns over the last 30 years. This is work by Bess and Binder.
1% of stocks produced 83% of the
Total value creation. And 5% generated 128% of returns.
Wow.
So the other 95% in aggregate destroyed value. So it's not that all of those stocks destroyed value, but on aggregate they did. Yeah, yeah. So what does that make you do? You need to think about what attributes you're looking for the value creators and what you're not. And believe me, in within the index, there are plenty of those value destroyers. So our job is to guide our clients through this, to help to protect their capital, to not put it in companies with poor corporate governance. That, there are the Russian oligarch-owned companies and all this kind of stuff, state-owned banks in China. 20 or 25% of the index is typically state-controlled. They are they don't care about you as a shareholder.
Because I think we would intuitively know that, right? And I've heard myself talking to clients and we're talking about active versus passive. Fine, we don't want to get into that too much today, but generally speaking, in the likes of Asia emerging markets, Japan to a degree, we would prefer to invest client assets via active managers because the index can be so skewed. You've got, maybe it wasn't now, but I certainly remember that, Gazprom and Petrobras, the Brazilian oil giant, was one of the biggest stocks in the emerging markets. Well, if you buy an iShares MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, you're going to get 5% of your portfolio in that, which you're probably not, you know, your interests and the Brazilian or Russian government interests are most definitely not aligned in terms of generating shareholder profit in those stocks, right?
But you kind of be surprised. I mean, the trade in China recently was to own lots of SOEs. Yeah. So if you're a short-term investor, you would do that. Now, we don't. We own four fantastic businesses for the long term, which have been highly differentiated. We only got 10% of our fund in China.
Okay.
Whereas the convention in our industry would be, okay, you've got, say, 25% is your index weighting in China.
Yeah.
I'm not very positive on China, so I go 3% underweight, 3%, which means you've still got 22%. Yeah. And if there's a big benchmark stock, be it Chinese banks or oil companies or whatever else, you might not have 5%, you might have 3% in that stock and so on. And the same with Samsung and everything else. So our approach is to have a clean sheet of paper and construct a portfolio of the best stocks from wherever we find those best stocks. Still diversified, but not built around an arbitrary index that we do not think is your friend.
True.
It is not a good basis of risk management. And Russia was the kind of prime example of this in 22. A lot of people bought big Russian positions at the end of 2021 because the oil price was going up. So a lot of people found they ended up with a large Russia position just when all the tanks were building on the border. At that point in time, you do not reduce your risk by having a benchmark position in Russia.
Yeah, sure.
You know, there's a 30% chance of losing all your money. We went to zero.
Yeah. And that was right. So then it's sort of this idea of your, you know, your sweet spot of stocks with moats and with competitive advantages and with growth. Does that, where are those opportunities in terms of sectors and indeed geographies? If it's not Chinese state-owned banks or Latin America, I mean, where are you buying things at the moment?
We're not investing in GDP. We're not investing in markets. We're investing in companies. So we are pretty cautious about the growth prospects in Brazil and companies in Brazil in general. And yet we have 6% in one company.
Okay.
So that's a company called Nubank. And we bought that, I don't know, 12 months ago. It's up 80-odd% since then. It just had results, which are actually very good results, but the shares are off 10%. But that's because the market measures them on a short-term horizon. We think it's confirmatory for, you know, all our views on the next 5 years. So we're making every decision with a five-year view. And so where we find those best compounders are in particular parts of the market and particular markets and particular sectors. And so we tend to find a lot more in, for example, the Indian consumer sector.
Okay.
Consumer discretionary, not in consumer staples. We've been avoiding most of the consumer staples we had in the previous decade, which have actually lost competitive advantage.
They were on quite big multiples, those consumer staple stocks, right?
Yeah, but that's not the issue. That's the issue is if you're a Hindustan Unilever, which I sold in 2020, actually it's been a dismal performer for the last 5 years because it's lost competitive advantage.
Right.
It's quick commerce, Zomato and things like this are delivering products to your door, but they're not, you lose primacy, you lose your distribution advantage. So if you think about India, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of villages scattered and, you know, all over the place. And so if you go to all these little stores and your product is front and center, you had a big distribution advantage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it's going through e-commerce channels and they're using own brands and, you know, everything else, it's sort of suddenly they got more SKUs. So they've got more products they can stock.
Sure.
You lose that advantage.
Yeah, sure.
E-commerce is kind of grinding out some of the advantages you had for your brand, for your distribution.
Got you. And then do you spend a lot of time on the ground? Kind of, I mean, how do you, as an owner in Hindustan Unilever is a good example, you know, what led you to believe that they were losing their competitive advantage and therefore their potential profitability over the next 3 to 5 years? Was that being on the ground or could you see that in the numbers or what are the sort of, is it quantitative, qualitative, bit of both?
It's not the kind of thing you kind of notice by going around a bunch of stores. It's something where you're, yeah, we're constantly thinking around the world. What are the changes happening? What are the things which improve or challenge businesses? You know, some of the best investments we find are disruptive businesses. They're ones which come in and challenge an existing marketplace. So it could be like an auto trader in the UK coming in and disrupting all the dealerships and taking more of the rent. Same with Rightmove. You know, so we see these examples in the UK. We see the same kind of things being repeated. They can be brutally competitive for a, you know, for in India, you had the internet businesses, which were a horrible place to be for 5 or 10 years because all the people who'd missed out on the internet sector in China then put a lot of resources into that area. So private equity was battling it out. But actually, over the last year or two, we started to see the survivors coming out and then it become winner takes most in those situations. So we're trying to think about how the businesses fit together, how the market's evolving, how technology is changing things, what is the government doing? So there's a lot of digital payment infrastructure being built out in India and Brazil and so on, other places. But also how people are evolving. So the wealth has increased on a per person basis quite dramatically in India over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, and continues to grow. But we don't want to invest in the average person if we think the most rapid part of growth is in the upper middle class, which it is. So if you think about a normal distribution of income moving to the right at around 10% per annum, the hyper growth is in the kind of $5,000, $10,000 plus category, not in the average of the market. Yeah. So whereas we might have bought shampoo companies 5 or 10 years ago, now we like the Domino's Pizza franchise, the leading jewelry company, those kind of things. Or actually the company's providing the infrastructure for pension investment. Mm. So businesses like Quilter, the equivalent of those in India, is a very, very rapid growth market.
Yeah. And is India the biggest allocation in your portfolio at the moment?
It has been for the last 13 years. Right. I mean, it's been broadly 30% plus for 13 years, even when it was 5 or 6% of the index. And we're currently at just under 40%. Mm-hmm. So after that, we're into some of the ASEAN markets, Vietnam, Indonesia, those kind of things. Mm. And then idiosyncratic opportunities, so 10% in China, and you know, individual companies in places like Brazil.
Hmm. And we've touched on Russia and Brazil a little bit, but is governance and political stability, is that a factor in the process? Is it something you think about, or you're just buying the best companies and therefore what will be will be? You know, India's a pretty good example, right? We've had Modi, or we had Amit Mehta on from JP Morgan Indian Investment Trust 3 months ago, probably. Yeah. Talked a lot about the politics, and it was shortly before or shortly after the election. I can't remember. Is that a factor, and is that a sort of after, worry, or does it not sway you at all because you just want to buy the best businesses in your?
Yeah, I mean, I think the market's littered with failed EM funds who thought you could blank out the jurisdiction.
Right.
Mm. So I was last in Lagos in Nigeria in 2014. If I'd invested in the Heineken subsidiary there, which was the leading brewery at that time, and held it to today, I've lost 95% in dollar terms.
Wow.
So you just can't blank it out. We need to find companies which are able to flourish, and for the franchise to be able to flourish, to create that value, to create the growth, it's much better to have following winds or at least stability. Mm-hmm. So you can have a fairly stable market. So Brazil is not an unstable market. It's not the most exciting. We can find better places with more following winds, like India, where you've got great demographics with low credit penetration, with a really well-run economy under Modi. So that allows that company to flourish. Now, under the Singh government before Modi, it was okay. It's just much better with Modi, who's taken a lot of, unlike most politicians, including here, they took all the tough decisions for the long term. Mm. They've invested in growth. They put a lot of money into infrastructure instead of social handouts.
Right. Yeah.
Go there now, instead of having mud tracks and people squatting by the side of the road, it's 12-lane highways and monorails and all this kind of stuff. Amazing airports. So they've put in the infrastructure for the future. They put in good service tax, all those kind of things. They did the hard yards, which allows the companies there to flourish. Mm. So if we find someone going backwards, like we've had with South Africa with all the power problems and things, and or irresponsible fiscal policy, as we saw in Brazil in 2014, 2015, but still today they're running a 9.5% budget deficit, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And you pay the price through the cost of capital and the currency and all of those things filter into how you're thinking about the valuation of future cash flows.
Okay. And obviously, India's seen quite a large expansion in the multiple that the equities are trading on. Is that of concern, or do you still think there's the same opportunity set there?
I think there is. The problem you have is a lot of the big funds that you would typically come across just own the same big banks and the big staples companies and the big IT service companies, which is not the exciting, interesting bit of the market.
Is that part because of liquidity or benchmark weights, liquidity?
Mm. So some of the big guys, some of the big American houses you'll be familiar with would be running $50 billion plus in EM.
Right.
I think it's very hard to be properly active if you're more than $10
billion. $10 billion. Mm. Right.
So we're targeting $3 billion to give you a flavor. Yeah. Mm. We're $350 million today. And that allows us to go and, you know, buy $5 or $10 billion market caps in size, which can generate much better returns with a lower level of risk.
Mm.
And we're not constrained into the companies which are growing at 5 or 10%. The average growth across our portfolio is around 25% in terms of earnings growth this year.
And so what's the multiple of the portfolio? Do you have that?
Pretty similar to that.
Is it?
So it's about a one-time peg. Yeah. So the price earnings versus the growth is a a sort of like a valuation convention. You should pay up for growth. Mm. But if you can get sustainable growth, and these are driven by sustained ROE and so on, then actually this is something it's looked like this for a very long period of time. For the last 13 years, we've always had a portfolio which has traded at quite a significant multiple, and yet it's outperformed 6% per annum. So the cumulative effect of that is we've generated 150% or so return versus the market doing 40-odd. Mm. It's a very, very big cumulative gap over time. And so on a rolling 5-year, it's actually, you get lower level of risk, a lower volatility, and a much higher return. And like a year like this year, you know, we've got some of the lowest drawdown in the sector, but the highest return.
Yeah. And your biggest position in the portfolio, which is a stock that many might know, Taiwan Semiconductor, do you want to sort of talk us through what they do, or the investment case around that, and you know why you're still pretty keen on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most difficult thesis. I mean, when I launched the strategy at Newton in 2011, this is my biggest stock, and it's still my biggest stock. And it hasn't always been the biggest stock in between. It has its ups and downs. And when it's vastly popular and you think it's a bit over ahead of itself, then we've trimmed it back and then topped it back up when it has a dip. But it's
i.e. when people get worried about China.
And all that kind of stuff, I mean, but also it's just the semi-cycle. So if you're a typical Taiwanese analyst, TSMC is half your index or more. So you're trying to beat TSMC and you're trading around violently backwards and forwards. Yeah. It's a bit stupid, isn't it, really? I mean, why do you want to do that? But you get it the same with UK and the banking sector or whatever else. You just get lost in this kind of game. Yeah. And we don't see investing as a game. We see it as we're trying to do the best thing for our clients for the long term. And so if you think in that kind of mindset, it's been a company which is growing at around about 20% per annum for the last 13 years. It's actually growing at a faster rate than that at the moment. We think it's probably significantly undervalued. You've just had Intel having to shut down a lot of its chip production and farm that out to TSMC, which is just further solidifying its leadership position. It's actually exerting market power over NVIDIA right now, you might not be aware of.
So, is that right?
Yeah, it's increasing its pricing on NVIDIA.
Okay.
But it's also exerting a bit of a pressure on ASML, which is a key supplier. It's kind of holding back on some of the CapEx, which is I think that there's a bit of a negotiating tactic going on there probably. Okay. But it's a pretty low risk company, been very well governed. It was founder led for many years.
And Morris something, wasn't it? What was his name?
Yeah, Morris Chung, I think
Morris
it is.
Yeah.
But it's just been formidably well run. They haven't been greedy or egregious. They've reinvested in their business and made a really good margin, made a really good return on capital, but not excessive enough to allow others to compete. And Trump is there going, well, you know, this is not fair. We've got to put tariffs against all these kind of things. There is no alternative.
They're building a plant in Nevada, is that right?
Arizona. They just started one and they're building more. And they're doing the same in Europe and the same in Japan, but they're getting heavily subsidized to do so.
I was going to say, they're being given billions, right, from the US government.
Well, it costs 3 or 4 times as much to build a plant there because the workers are much less productive.
That's what I was going to say. It's taking much longer to build the plants, isn't it? Because they don't work as hard, essentially.
They had to send a whole bunch of Taiwanese workers out there, basically, to sort it out because everyone was off on fag breaks and all that kind of stuff the whole time. That's the reality of it. So it's
and then you sort of touched on it there, but like the US dollar and what happens in America is arguably as important, if not, you know, one of the most important things for the relative performance of emerging markets. I guess when the US is doing well and the dollar is strengthening, emerging markets as a homogenous group tend to be weak. Does the sort of Trump administration threat of tariffs, does that sort of concern you in terms of the fund and what you've got in the portfolio?
Yeah. If you go travel to the US right now, it's kind of eye-wateringly expensive.
And people say that.
Yeah, we don't necessarily expect that to reverse in a hurry, but the dollar tends to perform in kind of 10-year waves, and we're just on the end of a 10-year wave. So the temptation is always to extrapolate things. But markets have a habit of kind of reversing excesses. And, you know, the tactic of putting on a load of tariffs, you know, that just hurts your consumer and it makes you to have more zombie companies. So the US has amazing tech companies and, you know, we in Europe have been asleep and allowed regulation to kill our technology sector. So I think we used to have 30 or 40% of the tech sector. I think now only one out of the top 50 tech companies in the world is European, which is a very sad state of affairs.
Wasn't it the EU commissioner some sort of commissioner of the EU was asked by a journalist in an interview, you know, why don't we have good tech companies here? And he sort of said, reply back saying, well, we're really good at regulation.
<It's> like, really good or really bad. Yeah.
Tell me now.
Discuss. I think you can look at the dollar a lot, but the reality is that some parts of EM have done really well. If you'd invested in Latin American index for the last 10 years, you've lost money. If you put it into India for the last 10 years, you've made 200% in dollar terms. Now that's pretty, I think actually the India's ahead of the US still on a 10 year view and probably pretty close on a 5 year. And if you strip out the Mag 7, then it's awesome. So yeah, we are not investing in the index. We've given a very different return to the index over time. We expect to continue to do that because we're investing in companies with 15 or 20% annualized growth. But we're thinking in hard currency terms when we're making those decisions. Mm. We are not investing based in Turkish lira or something like that. And so if you're thinking about where you're actually going to find some serious growth going forwards, you know, I wouldn't bet against the Mag 7. I still think there's some amazing businesses. There are some challenges with AI that can favor some, and others could, I mean, Google could get wiped out by AI quite conceivably. Yeah. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they're in the space race. And that's why things like TSMC are doing so well, because they have to invest it. They've got this existential threat to their business. Yeah. So we think that that's still probably a good place for people to invest. Domestic US, you want to be quite wary, I think, at the moment, because the valuations are very demanding for what you're getting.
Europe, it sort of feels like in the US that the Mag 7 were always on a premium rating. The rest of the market looked okay, 16, 17 for S&P 493. The rest of the market, the valuation's gone back up into the 20s. You look at it.
I think we're moving away from emerging markets, but I think there is a bit of an obsession by everyone that we're waiting for the rest of the market to catch up to the Mag 7. And actually, should it do? Probably not on the growth.
The Mag 7 is not at a premium on a peg ratio. I mean, the ROE, it's moved up with the ROE. And, you know, if they lose their dominance, yes, but they've got to lose their dominance for that to happen.
It's quite hard to see them lose the dominance short term.
Well, apart from the AI thing, which, as I say, could favour some and challenge others. And, you know, someone like Amazon's going to try and challenge NVIDIA, as is Arm Holdings.
And actually, we were talking about this the other day. It's the first time you've really seen them start competing against each other. I mean, they've sort of always had, historically, they've really had their own business kind of portions, and now they are coming.
It's a fight for survival. Yeah. It really is. And so, we can invest in companies, through that value chain in Taiwan and Korea and stuff. We have nothing in South Korea at the moment.
Okay.
And that's been quite a good avoid, actually, this year. But where we find the best opportunities, the other big area of growth is places like India, Indonesia, Vietnam. You've got these rip-roaring economies with some really good businesses in there. Mm-hmm. Well-governed, high-quality businesses, very robust franchises, which are growing at, typically 15, 20, 25% or even more in some cases. And that's where we're going to make these amazing kind of compounding returns, not by mimicking the index.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think in terms of people's portfolios, you're not going to find that in the UK or Europe. And I know that's the convention is to buy your local market. I wouldn't want my money in the UK market, sadly, because of the components in there.
We love the FTSE. That's personally. We love the FTSE. Yeah.
But, I think that we're trying to give you the best 25 or 30 opportunities in a high conviction, but high quality, fit for purpose portfolio to give something different, which is not going to look like the EM index.
So asking an EM manager the question, if you were a global asset allocator, do you think the opportunity set today is more attractive than 5 years ago in terms of EM, or it hasn't changed? You're seeing just as many opportunities, but on a relative growth kind of valuation level, would you be upping your EM exposure?
I would, because the US market, which is 70% or so of the index, is highly valued. So I used to be a global PM, and I know all the stocks pretty well. And we follow what's happening in the Mag 7 because they influence the rest of the world.
Yeah, of course.
And within our global portfolio, the US is down to 40%. So this is just a little model I run for fun. Mm. So it's got about 40 or 50 stocks in there.
Yeah.
It's down to 40% in the US, which will be dominated by, Mag 7 and a few other great businesses. And we're probably about 40% in EM. And then 20% is represented by very, very select European and Japanese whatever.
You don't own a FTSE company?
Yeah.
I think I've got Ashted.
Okay.
I think Greggs is great. There are a very small number of good businesses.
Got Relics?
No, doesn't quite make the grade.
Okay.
But it's a great business. I wouldn't disagree with something like that. So those are the great ones.
I think as I spend more time doing this, we can all sit here and look at cash flow yields and P ratios and 12-month forward growth rates and say, that's a good value stock, that's an undervalued stock, that's overvalued stock, and put in portfolio. The more I do it, the more sort of you know, kind of Warren Buffett maxim it is. Like, no, 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 you just want to buy a really good company that's got impenetrable margins and can carry on growing and is not going to get usurped by technology or competition.
Yeah. Now,
those businesses are really difficult to find. And they don't, you know, as you mentioned with Hindustan Unilever, it's not, sometimes things change and you have to move on and you make mistakes. Yeah.
Mm. And so on that, you know, our biggest position for the last 18, 24 months has been a Pepsi bottler in India.
Mm.
And, you know, we had something like a 10%, well, close to 10% within the USITS for a 2-year period. And it's up, you know, a couple of 100% over that time horizon in a very low risk business.
Yeah.
But if you think about something like Pepsi, or just carbonated beverages in Europe, I mean, what's the consumption growth? 1% if you're lucky?
Yeah, yeah.
In India, it's trending 15% volume growth. Then you've got another 5% of pricing on. Then their mix is improving.
Hmm.
The cost of a bottle of Sting energy drink is 25 cents per bottle. So that will go up to, call it, $1. And they're drinking 4 liters a year per person. So as the wealth, that ability to afford more in a very hot country goes up over time, that 4 liters gravitates towards the 150 liters we see in Mexico or the US.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, maybe we don't get there, but maybe we get to 40. That's 10 times as much.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can see that happening in a 10, 15 year kind of horizon. So the compounding effect on that with a business model which is generating a 30% return on equity today and increasing is incredibly powerful. The asset turns, the margin robustness, the sustainability, the revenue growth in a very well-managed business in a duopoly. So you've only got Coca-Cola and Pepsi dominating that carbonated beverage market. If you look at that on a 12-month horizon, you say, oh, that's trading at, you know, I don't know, 60 times multiple and, you know, I wouldn't touch that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you just step back and then look at the long-term charts of some of these things, it's just quite profound how sustainable the growth rate is if you get the right business. So the question is it the right business? Is it well-governed? What's the sustainability of its market position? What's the sustainability of its profit? And if you do that, then the Indian consumer market is good for the next 20 years as a growth opportunity.
So that's interesting. So if you've got a stock today on a 60 times PE and it's growing at 20 or 25%, those earnings double in, what, 3-4 years? So all of a sudden, 3 years out, the stock is at 30 times, which you've still got a fantastic business because it still works forward. In fact, Ben Artekalan did say, the thing with buying really good growth companies is that if you're buying a stock growing at 20% and the multiple is high, so even the multiple doesn't collapse and there's no reason the multiple should collapse, it might go from 40 to 30, but you know, you've got the growth. The growth is your return. Yes, you might get some mild derating over time, but ultimately.
And again, it comes back to, you know, a stock that's on a peg of one. If those earnings carry on growing, it's not on a peg of one for that long.
No.
Yeah, so therefore we have what we call the checklist, which is trying to build our conviction in each case. And it's what pilots and surgeons do. And, you know, we just start with governance. Is it a founder-led business? Has they got skin in the game? What's the incentive structure? These are the key components. Then how robust are the moats? What are its kind of, you know, is it a good corporate citizen? Yeah, you know, we want to give capital the companies deserve it and do good stuff with it, things that society needs. So we'd much rather have the solutions to climate change. You know, we last bought an oil company in 2016, for example. We don't own tobacco and things like this, but we want these amazing businesses which are going to generate something really powerful for the future for consumers. And it's amazing how often they surprise to the upside. So we've just got this amazing following wind behind us. As long as we stick with that kind of process, that consistency, which is what we've been doing for the last 13 years, you can generate a dramatic different outcome.
Definitely. Any more questions from you, Husey?
No? Don't think so. That was fascinating.
No, it's been great.
It's actually really nice and interesting to sort of hear, you know, from a really active manager that is largely ignoring the benchmark and you're just trying to pick great stocks.
Great businesses.
And try to perform.
We do own one stock in the top 20 of the benchmark.
Yeah, well, it's just absolutely fair. Good. Yeah. Well, thank you, Rob. Thank you very much for your time today. Thank you all for watching and listening. Any questions, get in touch, particularly the stories of missing AirPods on train stations. I think that's amusing. And we'll see you all next time. Thank you very much.